interests and church involvement. In preparation for the session, each of our panelists was asked to give serious consideration to the following questions. Number one, what to you are Mormonism's most compelling doctrines? Two, have there been any intellectual or spiritual dilemmas in your life that have been resolved by Mormon thought or spiritual experiences derived from the church or gospel? In addition to your family affiliation with the church or your upbringing in the Mormon faith, what makes you a Mormon? Four, how has Mormonism influenced your thinking and behavior? That may be the question that we'd hope that they would delete, because I know that one's very encompassing. Five, could you ever cease to be a Mormon? And last but not least, what are the anchors or pillars of your faith to which you hold steadily in dealing with uncertainty, the future, personal challenges, and the world around you? Now let me introduce each of them, and as they make their remarks, I'd like them, if it is not a part of their presentation, to tell us a little bit about themselves in addition to that which is found on the program, to tell us about their early life experiences as a child or a youth or even as an adult in the church, something about their family constellation and what it was like for them growing up as a Mormon, and anything else that they think would be relevant to their remarks. On my left, let me introduce Dick Cummings. As the program indicates, he's a professor of languages at the University of Utah and also director of its honors program. To his right, we have Shirley Ryrie, the co-director of the Ryrie Woodbury Dance Company. On my right, and I've discovered today that she happens to be a relative of mine, Mary Bradford, the former editor of Dialogue and present editor of Mormon Women Speak, and Douglas Parker, professor of law at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at the Brigham Young University. Let's turn the time now over to Mary Bradford. And I think she can just stay seated and we'll... Okay, great.
I need the support from down here as well as up there. When I first heard the title of this panel, I misunderstood it as Pillows of My Faith. After a hearty chuckle, I decided that pillows would make a better metaphor. After all, pillars can crumble in a quake, can be mashed, can be toppled by a Samson, whereas pillows can comfort, support, and as in Utah, sandbag against disaster. I realize, of course, that pillows can also be mashed, run over, and otherwise rendered useless by life. Pillows are more flexible than pillars, and flexibility is not a word one generally thinks of in connection with faith. But faith is not synonymous with certainty. As Lowell Bunyan puts it, faith is not cut and dried. It is not fixed and static, but it is something as dynamic as life itself. Realizing that metaphors, and I don't know if this should be really dignified with the term metaphor, it's more like a conceit. Metaphors break down as quickly as the stuffing of a pillow. But I have organized my remarks around the pillows that comfort and heal, the bolsters that shape the principles I live by, and the sandbags that protect my values. The pillows seem to be mainly associated with my childhood and youth, where I was taught the principles that shaped the bolsters of my adulthood. I grew up as a first child of parents who loved each other and who taught me to believe that I was a miracle baby. Shortly after my birth, I was given the blessing by a bishop who arrived after the doctor had given up on me. This healing event taught me to think of life as a gift, with the gift of healing at my disposal. The comforting ward I belonged to, Grandview Ward in East Mill Creek, was populated by a number of my relatives, including a band of cousins and your parents, Brother Egan, who accompanied me through all the way through high school. The ward's dedicated teachers and leaders kept the boundaries between age groups flexible. This augmented the close ties that I forged with my two brothers and one sister, bonds that grow stronger with age. In fact, the many male relationships I have enjoyed throughout my life seem to fall into Tom or Dennis patterns. And my calling as a kind of second mother to Gay gave me much useful experience. Though my parents had little formal education, they were proud of what my siblings and I were able to attain. They encouraged us to go as far in school as their austere budgets would allow. My diary records that I worked for a year between high school and college, but that my earnings barely covered two quarters tuition. When I burst into tears at the thought of quitting until more money could be raised, my father exclaimed, "You're going back to school if I have to rob a bank." Then he turned to Mother with the words, "What's $50 if she's going to be unhappy?" Family unity, friendship networks, church activity, and an obsession with education led me to the University of Utah, where I came under the influence of some remarkable teachers and mentors, and to the Institute of Religion across the street. I had grown up amid rumors about loss of testimony, supposedly sustained by hapless students at the U, sometimes even loss of life to suicide, supposedly because of godless professors, but I felt my testimony actually expanding under the likes of Myrtle Austin, Dorothy Snow, Brewster Gieselin, Sterling McMurrin, Ness Smart, Lowell Lees, and especially Bill Mulder, my thesis chairman. Bill talked me into writing about Virginia Sorensen as my subject because she was a Mormon novelist writing about the background that I knew and she knew, and he felt that this would help me to understand myself better. Though Bill and Virginia were no longer active in the church, I grew under their high standards and integrity. At the Institute, I joined Lambda Delta Sigma, the church fraternity, and took classes in everything from world religions to courtship and marriage. I now believe I was there at a charmed time for the church education system, under a group of dedicated, brilliant men, Lowell L. Bunyan, T. Edgar Lyon, George Boyd, with a memorable assist from Secretary and Mother Superior Ethel C. Smith, and that popular seminary teacher Marion D. Hanks. During the 7 years I spent in their company, I was a slow learner, it took me that long to get through, T. Edgar Lyon's unfailing devotion to the cause of honest history, George Boyd's attention to the best in scholarship, and Lowell Bunyan's quiet devotion to the Christian life came to represent to me Mormonism at its best and dearest in every way. In fact, Lowell Bunyan came to symbolize all the pillars of my faith so completely that even today, the still small voice of my conscience often speaks in his voice. through his teachings, his writings, his counseling, his work parties, his Christian service projects, I began to take responsibility for my own life as well as for my own part in the church. It was in his company that I first began to think of the church as my church, as belonging to me. A full account of his philosophy is impossible here today, but I think of it as a mainstream gospel. I know that I was being carefully imprinted with the values of Christ. When I finally departed the Institute and the U for another safe place, it was to the full-time, my first full-time job as instructor in English at BYU. Here I found another delightfully individualistic band of teachers and friends who embellished the themes I was attempting to shape into a life. Leonard Rice, Clinton Larson, Ed Hart, Aurea Tanner, Jean Ann Waterstrat, and my wonderful office mate, Jeanette Morrell, to name but a few. It was here that I had the opportunity to test the courtship principles I had learned in Brother B's classes. Charles Bradford was teaching economics there, and he and I, having graduated from the ABC method of dating, traveling all the way to Z, were ready to take on the rest of the program. Travel with your intended, chaperoned, of course. Enter into a secret engagement before sharing your plans with the world, and marry in the temple after careful study of temple ordinances. Brother Ben Nin Lyon and Boyd gave us the Institute for our wedding reception, and we taught one more semester before departing for Washington, D.C., and Chick's new job with Senator Bennett. My long childhood was over, and the pillows of my youth began to harden into the bolsters of my maturity. All of my experiences up to this point seemed to be straining toward a synthesis that would join the secular and the sacral, the mental and the emotional. It was at the university and at the Institute that I was able to talk deep into the night about all the doubts and sorrows of my heretofore not very eventful life. It was there that I was able to meet with other students who were planning to offer their spiritual life to the world. At a writer's conference, I met with Jean in Charlotte, England, and Carl Keller, and heard them talk of their dream, which was to start a scholarly Mormon journal. I offered to help, even though my marriage was imminent and my plans unsure. We reasoned that people like us who wanted to write and publish could offer ourselves by anxiously engaging in promoting this idea whose time had come. Like many other young people of the 60s, we were looking for a cause that would engage our passions, our faith. During my formative years then, my pillows were mainly people. Joseph Smith's declaration, "If my life is of no value to my friends, it is of no value to me," was my motto. Although I had been warned against putting my faith in the arm of flesh, I went ahead and did it anyway. And I have never been sorry. So many of my fellow men and women combine the best male-female traits that I think of as being God himself. They were willing to let me learn from their mistakes while I grew strong enough to admit to my own. Well, I guess I must have said something wrong. Did you do that?
Now back in full power.
What did I say? Because these people stood their ground in so many ways, I found the courage to to reach out for my own conviction experiences. During my early years, the many nurturing men in my life kept me from noticing the concerns that would plague me and the rest of womankind later on. It was later that I became involved in women's studies and through further seeking, came to think of myself as a Mormon sister. My wide acquaintance with women around the church and my luck in being able to publish so many of them has given me a testimony of their strength and trustworthiness. As more of them find their voices, as they are doing here today, I become ever more desirous of being counted among them and sharing their gifts of the Spirit. Now on to the bolsters, or the principles, that grew out of this. I have to begin with my formulation of God by first describing what He is not. He is not a cosmic real estate broker whose major duty is to dispense kingdoms to worthy recipients. He is not a giant puppeteer who plucks people off the earth at inconvenient times for unclear reasons. Nor is he an entrapment officer engaged in a kind of sting operation. In fact, God does not cause death or any form of evil, but is engaged with us in the fight for good. God is in history and is somehow, some ways, limited by the laws which He, with us, is subject to. I regret that my own limited vocabulary finds me using such a limited word as limited, since I also believe that His ways are much higher than our ways, and that He surpasses our understanding. By this token, I am hazy about His appearance. I am absolutely certain He has never appeared on a videotape at a visitor center. I suspect that the same people who would balk at presenting a representation of a mother in heaven because she is too sacred and pure are the ones who design these Disneyland mannequins. This kind of PR is offensive to me and to my concept of Heavenly Father. To sum up, I believe that because of my free agency and my uncreated being, or my preexistence, I am engaged with Him in the fight for good. Because of that, I don't blame Him for evil, and I can go on worshiping and loving Him. I believe too that there is a certain amount of what some have called random evil in the world, which neither I nor anyone else I know has specifically caused. I can pray for courage, I can do my best to follow a prudent course, but when this kind of evil, whether by accident, disease, or death, comes my way, I do not have to blame my eternal Creator. The older I grow, the less I pray for certain events and things, and the more I pray for the strength to stand on a rock and do what I feel to be right, even if I have only a dim understanding of the consequences. Prayer, therefore, becomes a deep form of comfort and meditation. For the most part, I do not think very much about the devil. Brother Benning used to say, "Tell the devil to go to hell." By that, he did not mean that he did not stand in respectful awe of the powers of evil, but that to live life by seeing the devil around every corner was counterproductive. My naturally optimistic spirit prompts me to do likewise. pondering the nature of God and of evil naturally leads me to come to terms with the authorities in my life, especially those who are said to speak for God and act in His name. We shall always need authorities to guide us, says Brother B, but we must learn to test their right to lead us. This we can do through thought, experience, and revelation. This, in fact, is incumbent upon us if we truly value our agency. I am comforted by the concept of division of labor in the kingdom. I have my job, you have yours. We are both required to seek our own revelation. If yours contradicts mine, I must study out the differences through prayer and expect you to do the same, keeping always in mind that unrighteousness ends priesthood authority. Unlike some of you, I have never been called in by my bishop or stake president to defend my testimony. But if I had been, especially during my years as Dialogue's editor, I would have expected my leaders to fast and pray with me about the right course and then to allow me my own decisions. I realize that some leaders have more power over me than I over them, but I feel ultimately love should win out over power. If I relinquish my right to this process, I shrink from my own labors and shall be counted a slothful servant. Along with this, I do not believe in infallibility on any level, especially my own. I have always been active in the church, except for two brief periods, just before my courtship and marriage, and just before my call to take over Dialogue. At these times, I thought that I must be quietly leaving the church. But now I realize they were only silent sabbaticals. I was at some crossroads, disgusted with some of the direction of church policies and programs, and seeking new direction for myself. The decisions that followed put me into the mainstream again through my entrance into my own new family life, and later through engagement in the cause of independent publishing. When I retired from Dialogue 2 years ago, I wrote my feelings this way. I feel such a combination of pain, guilt, elation, joy, regret, and fatigue that to describe Dialogue as an intellectual scholarly journal is just not good enough. When I consider the passion and the energy that went into the founding of it, and its continuance for 15 years, I can only think of another friend who cried out in frustration, "I have to worship in my mind." Worship is emotional, spiritual enterprise, compassionate and passionate. And so is Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. I and my friends needed to offer up their talents and interests. We felt church publications could not possibly use all that we wished to write about, or to edit, or to design, and we felt it was an idea we should follow through. My service was in the best volunteer tradition and put me in touch with some of the best minds and hearts in the whole church. Because it represents the examined life, it brought me closer to the principles I had espoused but had never really tested. There is much more, but I shall move on to the third part of my pillows metaphor, the sandbag. We in Zion East were heartened to learn that this year Utahns were ready for the floods. Their brightly colored sandbags, combined with their fasting and prayers, averted disaster. In some ways, Salt Lake has always been a walled city, isolated in a ring of protective mountains, settled by people who believed they would be safe here. Now we know that Utahns are probably no safer, no more protected than anyone else. But the habit of thinking lingers on. Instead of dwelling on food storage, which I believe in, bomb shelters, which I don't, I prefer to think that the sandbags of my faith can be best described as creativity and courage, traits I deeply hope for. If these are combined with ethics and common sense, I believe they constitute the best protection. Brother Benyon places creativity at the top of his stack of bolsters. He says, when we are creating, we are most like the Creator. As Bushman and Ships pointed out earlier, our culture tends to celebrate the Enlightenment. This means that the left brain takes precedence to the eclipse of the right brain, or what I call the salamander effect. Our creative selves provide the energy to write poetry, to paint pictures, to create drama, and to find new ways of seeing. In my search for wholeness, I wish to bring up the submerged artifacts of my dreaming self so that I may better solve the conscious problems in my life and make my own work better. The other sandbag, courage, is almost another word for faith itself. A saint is someone who is taking a risk, says Diane Satterup, which fits Maslow's definition of a self-actualizing person characterized by an absence of fear. This part is dramatically embodied by the person of my husband, a physically disabled person who draws on his tremendous store of courage simply to haul himself out of bed in the morning. His ability to be truly cheerful, optimistic, and humorous lifts his accomplishments in career, church, and family to the heroic plane. I'm always been one who's known as a hovering mother. If I had been granted my wish, my three children would have been denied the glory of the Shenandoah or the Grand Canyon because I was forever snatching them back from the overlook. Because of Chick, they were saved from a crippling far worse than any physical disease. My many older friends who have struck out on paths that I would like to follow also signify great courage in later years. One of my mentors is here, Helen Stark. Her good friend and mine, Algie Ballas. Greta Peterson's mother also counts as one of my mentors. My thesis subject, Virginia Sorensen, and my good friend, Esther Peterson, have all taught me to take risks. And they are in their 70s and 80s. Algie has now passed away. I feel now that I need to help others to use courage and creativity so that we can figure out how to keep from building bomb shelters and how to keep from blowing up our planet. If this is our church, it is also our planet. And we, some of us believe the kingdom. It will be the kingdom we hope to attain. Shouldn't we be doing something to preserve it? Should the things that matter most be at the mercy of the things that matter least? That is Brother B's definition of faith. It should not. I suppose it doesn't really matter what conceits or what metaphors we use, whether it's pillars or pillows. They seem to lead us to the stage where we hope that faith will give way to things seen and we can walk uprightly in knowledge with our God. Thank you.
Almost every generation of Judaism has been marked by a few singularly gifted rabbis who had a great influence upon their age. God frequently sent them in pairs, one strict, one lenient. Many of them, most of them, were known for their profound interest in expounding Torah and Talmud. But there were a few who changed their age because of their capacity for profound feelings. In saying that, I would like to acknowledge the presence of my wife, who is here, because she is one who has profound feelings. I'm just punching my plus stopwatch here. What leads me to believe in God, and where do I come by the qualities that I assign to God? A friend of mine who has troubles with humanism said to me that he knows that man is important and that mankind, men and women, are of supreme importance to God, but that we can not know man except insofar as we see him in the reflected light of God, that we must first come to know God as a means of coming to know man. I do not wish to disparage his position. I want to hear it. I want to see it and feel it as he sees it and feels it. For me, however, experience and reflection have pointed me in a different direction. I attribute to God virtues and qualities that I see in man. I come to know God by seeing him in the reflected light of man. I personally believe that we must come to know man as a means of knowing God. In addition to each other, God sent Jesus so that we could see God in the reflected light of his Son. I suppose that this would make me a theistic humanist. I believe in God, and man helps me know him better. A psychologist friend of mine, a close dear friend, calls himself an atheistic humanist. After a talk at our cabin a week or two ago, he decided that a better label for himself might be a non-theist humanist. Another friend calls himself a secular humanist or an agnostic. He doesn't want to relate his humanism to a belief or a disbelief in God. But we do not think of friends in terms of labels. We love them. Most everyone whom we come to know contributes to a reflection of what we hope eternity is like and exhibit qualities that we hope God possesses. A person does not have to believe in God to provide us with a view or an idea of what we might desire God to be like. Something that came to my mind in reflecting on this matter are the pictures hanging in my office of four men whom I have known and loved deeply. My first dean at the University of Colorado, a very thoughtful agnostic, a colleague who had the office next to mine, a person of profound gentleness, not a member of any church, David Dalby, a Jew, who is universalist in his love of persons, and Felix Nestlinger, an Austrian. All are non-members of my church except Felix Nestlinger. On some occasions, I look up at the pictures on my wall, and I say to myself, I love you, Ed. I'm grateful to you, David. These are persons with whom I have had a simple, intimate, open, intellectual, and simple time of sharing. In one sense, I guess it could be said that I have had a deeper, closer, more wide-ranging relationship with a number of friends than I have had with God. The important thing for me is that they have helped me find what I hope is God's nature. I have a hope that God embodies the noblest qualities that I have seen in other people, and that He loves me as they have loved me. I have faith that God gives these qualities eternal purchase. There are indeed hazards and limitations to coming to God this way. First, it is culturally confined. It does not transcend culture. It is theologically, culturally bound. What I want to become, what I believe God is, are drawn from that which I have experienced and known in my own culture. I acknowledge that weakness. And so I must assume then that God is greater than I can imagine Him to be. Mankind, for me, is not a substitute for God. I believe in man, with whom I am closely associated in this seen world. Why do I believe that there is a loving, caring power, or supreme being in the unseen world, whom we refer to by the term God? There are several personal answers for me as to why I believe that there is a loving, caring power or supreme being in the unseen world. Perhaps the most influential answer for me is because my childhood faith has not died out. It was planted in me in a loving way by tender, loving parents. It is the faith by which they lived and died. My faith is inseparable from my memory and my love of them. Also, I believe in God because one believes easily that which he hopes for earnestly, to use the title of one of our other sessions. I would not mind if God were a perfected man, an improvement upon some person down the street and around the corner whom I like so well. I do not believe, however, that coming to know God through our fellow man and through childhood faith are the exclusive and only ways to encounter God or a loving, caring providence. I believe in addition to coming to God through our fellow man and through our childhood faith, that there are moments of direct experience, and these serve as evidence, moments when we encounter Him directly. Man is not a substitute for God. In wanting earnestly to do well by these remarks, I did not say to the pictures on my wall, Austin, help me. I did not say, David, Ed, help me. I cried out in my heart, God, help me. In wanting to conquer the impatience and selfishness and perhaps arrogance and sharpness that sometime bring sorrow to my wife, I don't say, "Carl, help me." In the moment of my inadequacy and failure, in moments of my self-pity, I turn to a loving higher power. Many people of all faiths have direct and personal experiences that serve as evidence that some external force or power or being has some deeply personal caring for them. I was going to take the time, if time would permit, to mention three direct encounters in which I feel that some force or caring, loving power in the unseen world have acted upon me, but time will not permit. I see personal faith as something distinct from one's religious affiliation and accompanying religious faith. Personal faith embodies one's religious faith and builds on the foundation stone of one's religious heritage, but ought to have within it a place for convictions derived from other sources. In a sense, I think personal faith ought to be more expansive than convictions derived solely from religious affiliation. And I think personal faith should involve a reverence for these other sources, for they do not diminish one's primary reverence for his own heritage. The faith to be healed, a sensing of the closeness of some loving, caring power in the unseen world, some direct and personal experience that becomes evidence of the existence of God, are found in all religions and culture. The desire, the will, the faith to get better heals the Navajo, the Presbyterian, and the Methodist. I believe that spirituality and holiness are not institutionally patented qualities, nor are they the monopoly of any one faith. I do not believe that they are dependent upon church membership, although I do believe that they are often associated with loving participation in religious communal life. Qualities of deep humility, or of something that can only be called spirituality, can be found in persons of every persuasion. I have faith in the value of a pinch of skepticism in one's life to protect one from unexamined overbelief. And I believe that skepticism's value is aided by the capacity for rational, critical, independent thought. And I likewise have a deep faith in the value of prayer to protect us from underbelief. I think it's proper to say to God, "God, I believe, help me with my unbelief." I have faith in the value of doubt, in the moments and moments of doubt. Not doubt that displaces and competes with faith, but doubt that enhances and helps us see and value and be grateful for our faith. I speak of doubt that permits us to make an honest acknowledgement to ourselves that it is faith that we have and not knowledge. I believe that one cannot say that he or she has faith if one never has clear moments of doubt. Without doubt, one has cocksure knowledge. Moments of doubt inform one of how sustaining, how sufficing, how deep and beautiful his or her faith is. and doubts foster gratitude to God for faith. I believe that faith is more sufficing than knowledge and sustains us more effectively at moments of crisis, at the moments of death and the birth of loved ones. Faith, unlike knowledge, makes a place for examination and reevaluation of our hopes, and makes a place for the discourse of hope and of the things we hope for. I believe that we should resist the tendency fostered by membership in close-knit, exclusivist cultural or religious communities to dichotomize reality and to see the world on an in-group, out-group basis. The world should not be viewed as divided between Jew and Gentile, Muslim or non-Muslim and non-Muslim, Catholic and non-Catholic, Mormon and non-Mormon, or between those who both are in the world and of the world, and those who are in the world but not of the world. I believe that such dichotomizing impedes the capacity for sharing and for dialogue. I do not believe that it is wrong to have a love affair with the world, or to believe that there is more good in the world than evil. I enjoyed living for 22 years in Boulder, Colorado. I am uncomfortable with sermons that castigate the world. I know that there are both good and bad in the world, but there are both good and bad in me. I know that there are specific vices to be abhorred and preached against, but I am afraid of the attitudes that may be fostered by railing in general terms against the world. The term world is an abstract term, and I am not sure that I fully understand what it means. I believe deeply in communities, churches, church communities, and secular communities. I believe they are necessary and they are good. They provide security, they provide warmth and fellowship. And only in communities can we develop certain facets of our human nature. It is through life within communities that we learn statesmanship, achieve virtue, and distinguish the common good from self-interest. We come to know that there is a powerful idea called the common good. But I do not believe that a collective community identity should swamp and obliterate our individual identity. One who has given himself over to a collective identity, I should say one has given himself over to a collective identity, when one has immediately and without deliberation of all times come to think of himself solely in terms of affiliation or membership or some all-embracing membership that prescribes his place and role in all facets of life. A collective identity leads one to participate in groupthink, and the community ceases to be enriched by pluralism. I believe that happy and successful church participation should not be dependent upon all of the members being like oneself, or dependent upon the church leaders shaping up, or developing a social conscience, or freedom from racial prejudice as early as one supposes he or she has, or made dependent upon all people being like oneself is. I believe that such preoccupation has little to do with the pursuit of gentleness and spirituality, which church involvement ought to foster. I believe that we are burdened and sidetracked by the statement or concept of a testimony. We ask, Does he or she have one? Has he or she lost his? Much as we ask whether one has an orange, or has lost his orange, or ceased to value his orange. The striving for faith, living by faith, cannot be appreciated, measured, or adequately addressed by that phrase. In the matter of faith in Christ, of faith in God, I need all of the help and reassurance, fortification, and comfort that I can get. I believe that we should take comfort and find joy and reassurance in the pilgrimage of others, in all denominations, Christians and Jews and others, who have devoted themselves to finding God, or of who and what Christ was, persons whose faith was acquired by striving and was not a legacy from infancy carried forward and unexamined. I need a relationship with others that goes beyond the exhilaration of intellectual sharing. I need to share the quest of others, Christians, Jews, to honor and to serve God. I need to find some overarching common ground that allows me to celebrate the quest of others. I deeply need your faith. And I'm aware that my time is about up. I believe that to experience tension in one's search for faith and in one's church life is normal. A life of total homeostasis has no growth to it. There aren't two more different religions than Judaism and Mormonism. In Judaism, there is very little stress, very little concern for dogma. Almost total stress is placed on the way to behave, on the way to walk. Things that should be done, things that should not be done. Their God is a moral God. And in a sense, one, perhaps, can think of damnation following as a result of wrong behavior. There are pockets of dogma and stress upon dogma here and there among the sects of Judaism. And a thoughtful writer, Solomon Schechter, because of almost the total absence of anything constituting of an official position on dogma in Judaism, felt the need that there should be greater stress on dogma. In my church, there's an overwhelming preoccupation with theology and dogma. It's as if God were a theologian, and perhaps we fear that damnation might follow for incorrect thinking and false theological beliefs. And so I believe that each in his faith finds room and grounds for tension, and they force his growth, they deepen his life, they provide him bridges by which he joins the fellowship of man. I think we need to universalize God so that we experience him emotionally as a God who is working with other people in this life through their faiths. I think we have to go beyond God's special relationship with us. It's interesting to see the attempt that people have made in this regard. Jews have intellectually recognized to see God in his relationship to the non-Jew. But the job requires that one go beyond the intellectual undertaking. God's relationship with others must be celebrated in a feeling and in identification with them. And now, in closing, I'll just list you one or two things. I won't discuss them. The Mormon doctrines that are most compelling to me. What doctrines have special appeal for me? one eternal marriage. I more than just like that doctrine and hope for it. I am counting on it. Do I believe it? Well, I deeply hope for it. And if I deeply hope for it, it is easy to believe it. It bridges over into my deepest feelings and my behavior. I like the doctrine of life after death and our reunion with others whom we love, including the retention of our moral and intellectual growth in this life and our continued growth in the next. I like the fact that we have no professional class, that there's no distinction between clergy and laity. I like to be able, with my wife, to be the one who occupies the role of priest in our home. I like universal participation at the pulpit. It teaches me to listen, to try to overcome arrogance, to persons and to know persons who do not mirror myself. I like the sharing at our meetings. I like my experience as a bishop, a calling that involved profound satisfaction. I'm sustained by the goodness, the decency, the intellectual dependence of my independence of my children. I love Mormonism. I like most of its doctrines. I feel that it provides me my faith, my ladder to climb through the roof, like the faiths of others have provided for them their ladder to climb upward and through the roof and to see the world. Thank you.
Brother Egan asked me to give a brief autobiographical sketch, if I didn't have it in my paper, which I did not include. I'm a local girl, and really local. I've lived and grown up almost in the same neighborhood all my life. I grew up in the 33rd Ward, 11th East and 4th South. In that neighborhood were Brother Parker, whom I knew then, and Chick Bradford, Mary's husband. She told me that Chick said, gee, I wish I could come and hear my two old girlfriends speak. I don't know if she was the old girlfriend or I was the old girlfriend. Oh dear, I'm sorry. In that neighborhood were some wonderful people. I remember walking with Chick back from church every Sunday and having long discussions. My house came before his, and gospel discussions, and I treasure those. He taught me a great deal. My mother and father, Stan and Helene Russin, were greatly influential on my life. They're wonderful people, very involved in this community, and many of you knew them. In fact, I can go nowhere without someone asking about my mother and my father, of which I'm very proud. I now live very close to that same neighborhood. I've lived always around the university. The event university community has been very influential on my life. I grew up at Stewart School for grade school, which was on the campus. And many people in this room have been influential on that life. Last week, when I was getting a temple recommend, my bishop, Mike Cannon, said something to me that conjured up a verbal response of things I have thought about often but never verbalized. He said to me, most of us here in this ward give of our time and service to people within this close neighborhood. This is where we live, where we are known, and where we work and serve. But your good works are so much more widespread and affect so many different kinds of people. We appreciate what you do for our community and for those others in other places. I thought that was very sweet of him, and the two thoughts that I verbalized to him then were, one, and I'm going to elaborate on these a bit this afternoon, I feel that my goal in what I do is in its ultimate state spiritual. And two, I appreciate the fact that what I do is accepted by church leadership and members. This acceptance is remarkable because none of those people understand or really even know what I do. Even my family and my close friends, I mean, really no one except perhaps my co-worker Joanne Whitberry really knows what I do. Modern dance is untraditional and often controversial. Just this spring, in a letter to the editor in the Deseret News, a man said he complained about something we had done on the Salt Lake Arts Festival. He complained about too much disrobing. Now, that was my choreography that was responsible for that. The undressing was, I thought, integral to the idea of the piece. The piece was about high fashion, and my idea was to go from a cat fight with these women who were very interested in those, material things, and it got down to their animal nature, and in rhythmically taking off the clothes to count to the music, which I thought was pretty clever, we got down to the look that could be abstracted for the animal, which was a long pair of tights, waist to ankle, and a halter top, which I felt was closed, and was very little different than the leotards that we wear in most of the pieces we do, because this is a dancer's uniform. This brings up the whole question of sexuality in dance, which I thought if we had time later in questions, I'd be loved to go into, because I have some thoughts about that I think are kind of interesting. It basically means, though, how a culture, a specific culture, perceives what we do, and that could be any kind of a thing we do. For instance, dancing is considered a sin by some religions, even today. My main goal in what I do, in teaching, performing, or choreography, is to arrive at transcendence. I am very clear about this. I know what it is. It is the spiritual part of dance, or the manifestation of the human spirit in a broader sense. It is difficult to attain, doesn't happen often, but the process, the journey toward this goal is stimulating, and the few times of arrival well worth the quest. I feel you reach transcendence when your total self connects. You come together physically, intellectually, emotionally, socially, aesthetically, and thus spiritually. For me, dance is the possible pathway to this spiritual goal, and one that I practice throughout my life. I work with a lot of people who are non-Mormon, the dance department of the University of Utah, my company, and many of the people I meet when I travel are not LDS. Yet, I feel I am always pursuing this religious goal, which is non-denominational, yet spiritual, and I think good. I have met many good people on my travels among these non-LDS types. They have taught me much about the good life and about my religion, and I have appreciated that contact and friendship. The acceptance part of my two thoughts to the bishop was that somehow, without any words passing between us, my ward leaders have always understood that what I was doing, whatever it was, was to be allowed and not to be interfered with. I have felt accepted and exonerated for following this untraditional path. I have never been asked to take on assignments other than those which I could fill, which has been kind of remarkable. I travel a great deal, and I cannot be counted on for ongoing kinds of responsibilities. That, again, seems to be okay. I appreciate the fact that I have not been pressured or made to feel guilty in that respect. Or, as I realized as I listened to Marjorie Conder's paper Thursday, I wasn't pressured when in the 50s and early 60s I raised four daughters and worked time and a half. Even though that was supposed to be a certain path to delinquency for your offspring. I am most grateful to my church for people and programs which helped me raise my children. A church which taught my husband in ways to make him the most ethical, moral, and genuinely honest person I have ever known. Darn it. I always know what's going to be the tearjerker. I always cry when I speak. And it's when things touch me emotionally. My four daughters are deeply religious. They have strength of character and clear direction in their lives. The three who are married have chosen wonderful husbands. They are all active. Two in bishoprics in their 20s. Six perfect grandchildren. Grandchildren are always perfect. I take little credit in all of this. I tend to think that the intangible part of me that marries me in a deep way to the gospel is, again, without many words, perceived by my family. Mormonism's most compelling doctrines to me are the clear message structures which create a plan for day-to-day living, for helping us prioritize what is important, and when, if followed, creates then what I would term the good life. I love the practicality of our church, the fact that children participate, give talks, take on duties. I love the word of wisdom and the active word association, which helps make choices more clear. The central pillar of my faith is a feeling. I know the gospel is true. Oh, I become aggravated at biases and narrow thinking, but these behaviors are really not important in the larger view. I think my fortune came from my father, whose deep feelings about the gospel osmosed into my own being. My mother was born a Baptist, and being a very probing intellectual, challenged me often by criticizing actions or events tied to doctrines or people of the church. I listened. I never argued. There is no point. She was much more clever than I. But she caused me to think a lot about gospel principles. None of it ever shook my faith. I had a wonderful relationship with my mother, but the spiritual bond was felt through my father. I felt and do feel now that I always was a Mormon. When I was born, I was already. And I always will be. Now, why should this make me cry? It's what I am. And I know I will never change. I am not a scriptorium. I have a memory like a sieve. I am not a missionary. I don't feel comfortable pressing my beliefs on other people. But I love the church. You know, I heard that a man in Washington didn't want me on his committee because I'm too emotional, and I certainly understand why. I'm not a missionary. I excuse me, I love the church. I love what it stands for. I love the emphasis of home and family. I think Relief Society lessons are fascinating and inspired, and the women who work so hard to give them amaze me. I love the care and devotion so many teachers have given to me and to my children. And I love the fact that we are an active church, that we are doers. I have always trusted actions more than words. I love being a Mormon. Thank you.
I believe that time constraints have just reduced the pillars of my faith to pedestals and maybe even footstools. I'm not sure. And I swore I would not race through my paper, but I think I'm going to have to race through it if I'm going to make the points that I'd like to make. So please bear with me. Preparing for this panel discussion has been much more demanding than I expected it to be. To get in touch with what I really believe, the pillars of my faith, and not just what I think I believe, or what I ought to believe, in other words, to be ruthlessly honest, has required much soul-searching, a careful reassessment of my basic assumptions, and a good deal of groping for the right words to articulate what emerged. I must add that I am always tempted, when confronted by a challenge like this, to make a definitive statement. I now realize that the most I can hope to do is to capture my state of mind right now, and I know that it will not hold for the future because convictions, however firmly held, do evolve. As I look back over the years of my perspective on the Mormon experience, I find that for me, the most compelling doctrines of Mormonism can all be subsumed under the heading of eternalism, that felicitous formulation to which B.H. Roberts gave currency and which reached its fullest expression in Joseph Smith's King Follett Discourse. It was there that the prophet asserted that, and I quote, "The intelligence of spirits had no beginning, neither will it have an end. It is not a created being. It existed from eternity and will exist to eternity." Close quote. This basic precept that the conscious, willing, feeling center of man's being is an uncreated, eternal, and autonomous entity is to be found nowhere else in the philosophies, ideologies, or religions of the world. One is forced to conclude that Joseph Smith either invented it out of whole cloth or that it was revealed to him from a higher source. I find the second explanation to be much more credible. The other key doctrines of Mormonism that I have found most engaging and most distinctive are all closely related to the belief in man's eternal identity. And they include, one, the belief in man's status as a potential deity, as God now is, man may become, in Lorenzo Snow's familiar paraphrase, two, the principle of eternal marriage. As Sterling McMurrin has astutely pointed out, the Mormon belief system is the antithesis of the traditional Judeo-Christian theologies. Mormonism upholds an anthropocentric view that, from a traditional vantage point, is heretical in the extreme, but which for me has always had the ring of truth to it. Two key statements epitomize this heretical, man-centered religion. First, that it is the glory of God, and therefore his veritable raison d'être, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man, and secondly, that men are, that they might have joy. You have to stop and think for a moment how sharply this contrasts with the traditional notion that man's greatest aspiration is to glorify God, even though in that same system of thought, God has no need to be glorified. Before clarifying the bearing of these central doctrines upon the pillars of my faith, I would like to retrace the intellectual and spiritual dilemmas as well as emotional crises which have influenced the form which my innermost convictions have taken. And this will be a rather personal survey. The first such crisis was my father's untimely death when I was 12. It occurred when my family was living in Southern California, shortly after my mother and baby brother had left for a visit to Salt Lake City. My father prepared breakfast for my 9-year-old brother and me and sent us to school on the fateful morning. We returned home from school expecting to find him there. He was a self-employed photographer. We played around for a while and became increasingly concerned as dinner time came and went with no word from him. I finally prepared a makeshift meal, and soon it was well after bedtime, and there was still no sign of Dad. My younger brother went to bed, but I became more and more agitated and spent the night in a round of half-uttered prayers, desperate but unavailing forays into the Book of Mormon for guidance and for spiritual consolation, and occasional fitful lapses into nightmarish slumber. The next morning, a neighbor took us to the local police station to make a missing persons report, and we went to school. About 11 a.m., I was informed that my father had been located. He had climbed into a tree to take a color photograph. That was his specialty, and there were very few people at that time who could do that. Slipped and fell, broke his back in three places, and lay there paralyzed until someone found him the next morning. He lived another week in intensive care in a hospital, and I had some valuable visits with him during that time. He was a devout Latter-day Saint who did his own thinking, and I strongly identified with him. I was completely traumatized by that event, and I never completely got over the loss. As a result, during much of my adolescent and young adult life, I sought and found substitute fathers, always in a Mormon context and always in the person of someone whose standing in the church and whose grasp of its doctrines commanded my respect. The first of these surrogate fathers was my Uncle Frank, B.F. Cummings III, who was my father's oldest brother. He was for many years the head of the Department of Foreign Languages at BYU, where he also taught ethics and religion. He turned out to be both a father figure and a role model, more so than either of us expected at the time. And his well-thought-out and deeply held convictions about the church and Mormon theology profoundly influenced my own. More about him and another crisis later. After my father's death, we returned to Salt Lake City, where I entered the University of Utah 3.5 years later. And this brings me to the next dilemma. I was enrolled in the pre-med program at that time, and I was majoring in biology. I was required to take courses from a brilliant but controversial professor, Dr. Stephen Durant, whose specialty was vertebrate zoology, but whose passion was the theory of evolution. He seriously undermined my untested faith by demonstrating that evolution was not just a theory, but a law, and that it utterly precluded any form of supernatural creation. That was a real religion for him, and he used the lectern as a pulpit, and I was very impressionable. One of my closest friends was the grandson of Elder John A. Widsoe, and as you probably already guessed, Elder Widsoe soon became another important father figure for me. He succeeded in a few brief but sympathetic discussions in dispelling all my doubts and fears by pointing out that religion and science are not an either-or issue, but that the two can ultimately be reconciled, and that was a profound lesson in truth for me. I learned then and there that there is a safe middle ground, and I still firmly believe that this is the case, despite the vigorous assertions of a few iron rotters to the contrary. The next crisis came the summer before I was to leave on my mission, when I chanced upon Fawn Brody's recently published bombshell, No Man Knows My History. It's a horrible thing to read just before you go on a mission. Her unrelenting emphasis on the all-too-human side of Joseph Smith's character led me to my next major spiritual dilemma. Was Joseph Smith a true prophet of God, or simply a clever and ingratiating charlatan, in which case I could hardly justify my decision to accept the call to go on a mission? I wrestled mightily with that one, concluding finally that Mrs. Brody had not really succeeded in dismissing Joseph Smith, despite her thesis that his supernatural claims were unfounded. Indeed, she was so fascinated with his undeniable charisma that she was forced in the end to exalt him into a kind of superhero, an individual whose personal qualities bordered on the miraculous, but she could never quite admit that they were miraculous. As it turned out, I adopted a pragmatic view, had a pragmatic testimony at that point, convincing myself that my practical experience of Mormonism had been valuable to me, and that I owed it to the unenlightened French to at least tell them of the gospel so that they could make an informed decision about its worth. At this point, I would like to emphasize how much I value my mission experience. The competitive zeal of missionary life provided a marvelous corrective to the doubts and misgivings that Darwin and Brody had stirred up. The cultural and linguistic dimensions of the experience had incredible impact in that they completely reoriented my career objectives from medicine to the academic field. This shift was also strongly influenced by yet another father figure, President James L. Barker, who for many years had been head of the Department of Languages at the University of Utah, and whose mission presidency was characterized by powerful intellectual as well as spiritual leadership. Indeed, it was on my mission that I got in touch with the fact that I am basically a humanist, and it is obviously the humanistic side of Mormonism that I find so captivating, the radical notion that man is a God in embryo and that God is man fully evolved. The next crisis occurred in 1968. When my Uncle Frank submitted the manuscript of a book on the ethical implications of Mormon theology, his life work in a sense, to the Deseret Book, only to have it summarily rejected by the church reading committee. It was pointed out that while the work did not contain false doctrines or inaccuracies, it was couched in original terms which, quote, might offend the brethren, close quote. He published the book at his own expense and died a few months later, greatly disheartened by the entire experience. This obviously confirmed my growing distrust of the institutional aspects of Mormonism, the impersonal structural apparatus that seemed more and more to eclipse the highly personal spiritual insights and experiences that had given rise to the church. The last of the crises, which contributed however negatively to the pillars of my faith, occurred in 1977 with the breakup of my first marriage and my accompanying bout with severe depression. With 7 years of hindsight and in the wake of a marvelously successful second marriage, and I'd like now to acknowledge the presence of my wife, Julie, who is both a pillow and a pillar of my faith, it is now clear that that was a necessary and invaluable experience in personal growth and self-understanding. But it was a veritable wipeout at the time. The major point of it, for the purpose of this discussion, was seemed to contradict my basic belief in the validity of temple marriage. Despite my reservations about the institutional shortcomings of the church, I was firmly convinced that a marriage solemnized in the temple had real staying power. Although this one had lasted for 23 years, it clearly did not have the permanence I had ascribed to it. There were perfectly valid reasons why the marriage foundered: conflicts in values, incompatibilities, and the like. But in the process, another belief bit the dust and somehow had to be rethought. I would also like to say that I overreacted to the disillusionment, the bitterness of that experience. I wrote Mormonism off as a bad investment and decided it would be best for the church and me to go our separate ways. It did not take very long, however, for me to realize two things. First, that I could not so lightly dismiss a religion which had become so much a part of me. And second, that I had unwittingly lapsed back into the simplistic all-or-nothing kind of thinking that Elder Widsoe had helped me to rise above. I was tacitly agreeing with the advocates of monolithic Mormonism who insist that one must accept the church in its entirety or reject it out of hand. In this connection, I would like to acknowledge three remarkable women who, without realizing it, enabled me to keep my Mormon roots alive by inviting me to continue to rethink my Mormon background and share the results with others. The first was Maureen Ersenbach Beecher. I'm sure many of you here know her. She's an outstanding scholar, historian, who has published extensively. In any event, she was the one who got me so involved in the newly founded Association for Mormon Letters that I somehow ended up as president of that organization. That meant that in 1979, I had to deliver the presidential address at BYU. I called it the Mormon Identity Crisis because it was a direct expression of my own personal identity crisis at the time. And this brings me to the other two women who both were in attendance at that AML luncheon at BYU. By a happy coincidence, one of them is on the stand with me today. And the other is none other than the founder of this August event. I mean, of course, Mary Bradford and Peggy Fletcher, who each approached me after the address to ask if they could have it for their respective periodicals. It's a very interesting phenomenon, by the way. I ended up giving it to Peggy, who brought it out in the next issue of Sunstone, but I promised Mary that my next publishable effort would be hers. The result was that I was delighted when a paper on Mormon literalism, which I read at the 1981 Sunstone Symposium, appeared in a subsequent issue of Dialogue. This process led to another paper on Mormon fanaticism, which I read at last year's symposium, and which appeared in a recent issue of Dialogue. As a final tribute to Peggy Fletcher, I must confess that I know of no one else on the face of the earth who could have gotten me to do what I'm doing at this moment. One of the questions which was posed to members of this panel to help them prepare their presentations was the following, quote, besides the accident of birth, what makes you a Mormon, close quote. I do not believe in accidents of birth. I am convinced we have a great deal to do with where and when we are born. In fact, I believe that is good Mormon doctrine. So I firmly believe that I chose to be born into a Mormon setting, and accordingly, there is a way in which I am, always have been, and always will be Mormon. But I must point out that I am Mormon by my own definition, not in terms of any institutional stereotype. Here, I must interject that the process whereby I have refined and personalized my belief system has been one of progressive internalization. As I've already suggested, I started out equating my religious identity with all the external trappings of Mormonism, attending meetings, obeying authority, giving 2.5-minute talks, performing ordinances, reading the standard works, and so forth and so on. But the more I have reflected on the matter, the more I have come to agree with 2 key statements made by the Savior in the Gospels of Luke and John, namely that my kingdom is not of this world, and the kingdom of God is within you. I guess the irony of it all is most apparent when I compare my present Mormon identity with the one I had as a child, as a missionary, and as a young Mormon husband and father. Externally, I looked much more the part then than I do now, because I was active and I fit the stereotype, whereas I now have only tangential involvement with the church as an institution, and yet I am much more in touch with how Mormon my core beliefs and values really are. One way of putting this is to say, as I have privately said in the past, that by conventional standards, I have a 15% testimony. And I was playing a game because I don't believe you can quantify these things, but I'm looking at it from the outside, and that's about all it looks like from the outside, a 15% testimony. Another way of putting it is to say that I started out with a 100% soft testimony, that is to say, a full set of approved but unexamined beliefs. I now have a hardcore, that almost sounds pornographic, I don't know, of limited but tested beliefs, which remain after carefully weighing the other 85% in the balance and finding them wanting. What are these hardcore beliefs? In other words, what remains after all the dross has been burned away in the crucible of doubt and experience? 1, our identity is synonymous with our intelligence, our unique, uncreated, essential self that has always been conscious and free to choose and always will be. For me, this leads to a merging of existentialism and Mormonism, and the result is a kind of open-ended, metaphysical existentialism. The basic assumption of existentialism that within the confines of our temporal existence, we are what we consciously and freely choose to become, is no longer confined to the brief segment of our lives that extends from birth to death, but open-endedly encompasses the full scope of our eternal nature. 2, there is ultimately no qualitative difference between our essential self and the essence of God. The human and the divine exist on an ontological continuum, and yet we each have our being separately and distinctly from one another. 3, each of us must recapitulate Joseph Smith's experience in the sacred grove in our own way, and in the same open-minded, inquisitive spirit, and with the same willingness to risk that he did. This is the highly personal inner path that we must pursue. 4, each of us must work out his or her own salvation. This may occur in an institutional context, or it may not, as experience dictates. 5, we must love our fellow man and woman and respect the individuality of each. Joseph Smith placed as much value on the inviolability of the individual self as he ever did on the authority of the church. In this respect, this love that we have to cultivate for each other in spite of our beliefs or because of them or whatever, I do consider Lowell Bunyan to be a model of someone who has actually put that kind of thing into practice in a way that all of us could benefit from imitating. This last point leads me to my conclusion. A brief discussion of the dilemma in which my particular brand of Mormonism puts me. Even though I consider my belief system to be based on the most fundamental tenets of the LDS faith, that system excludes so much of what mainstream members consider to be central to their faith, and which they espouse literally and totally, that I fear my divergence of belief will scandalize them. Consequently, if I wish to associate freely with church members, I have the choice of probably offending them with my true position, or I can offend my own sense of integrity by hypocritically keeping my real views to myself. Obviously, I have opted for the first choice today in a setting where I feel myself to be in the company of a number of kindred spirits. But what of a good fellowship of the gospel doctrine class or a priesthood meeting? I find irrelevant so much of what goes on in those settings that I cannot, in good conscience, attend them with any degree of frequency without experiencing one or the other of the aforementioned offenses, even though I don't in the slightest begrudge my fellow members their right, their religious priorities. Let me add that I am proud of my pioneer heritage, that I instinctively defend the church against its detractors when they speak out of ignorance or malice, and that I feel a strong sense of cultural and social kinship with my fellow Mormons generally. I do find, however, that in view of what can only be a controversially exclusionary testimony, a certain discretionary distance is the better part of religious valor. Thank you for bearing with me.
I'm sorry that we don't have time for questions and comments from the audience. The only encouragement that I would give is that each of you would have the same experience as the panelists, to take a look at the pillars of your faith, and perhaps go with the byword that was given by Shirley, I've always trusted action more than words. Thank you very much.